following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. Welcome to a Monday. You know, this week I said I threatened that I was going to take some time off, and I'm still planning on it. But today is sort of like a partial day. You know, I was going to take today off. And then on Friday, you know, my dear friend Brad Friedman, he understands that when you got to take time off, you got to take time off. And he talks me into filling in for him. But, you know, he does pay me for the work. So there is that. So I did his show on Friday. I gave him a wonderful episode, a couple of interviews, and I repackage it for his show. And then when he found out that Marcy Wheeler was here Friday, he said, well, how about you take Monday too and you run Marcy Wheeler? And I thought, you know, Marcy is just so awesome. And it was a great show on Friday. And I could fairly easily repackage it. But doing Brad's show is, God, it's a pain in the ass. For reasons that I'm not going to go into here. Just know it's a lot of busy work. So I said, okay, we'll do that. And so I did. So tonight at 8 o'clock or whenever you listen to the broadcast, you will hear Marcy Wheeler's appearance on this show from Friday. Because as much as often as I can spread around her information, the better, right? Okay, so that leaves this show. And I didn't have anybody booked, but I've been recording some interviews to save up. So, you know, to run on days that I take off. So here's the deal. We're going to talk. The phone lines are open, 954-889-6410 for anything you want to talk about. Or you can Skype in. If you're on Skype, I'm Nicole Sandler. Feel free, at least certainly during this first half hour, because in the second half hour, I'm going to play one of these two interviews. Okay? Because frankly, today is... if you saw the show card, I make up like a graphic for each program. And today, because I wasn't promoting a specific guest, I thought, what's the mood of the world today? Well, the world has gone mad. I guess this was a movie. Let's see. What is MCMXXX123? Isn't that, I think it's 1933. Could that be right? I'm not up on my Roman numerals these days, but I guess it was a movie, but it is our life right now. So we're going to go over some news. Again, the phone lines are open. Should you care to call in, please do. And hold on 1 second. Ah, okay. So yes, you can. But I need your input. And I'll look to you guys in both the YouTube chat room. And if there's anybody there, the chat room on the Listen Live page at NicoleSandler.com. And I see there's a bunch of you in there, but nobody's posting anything. So, but you can. So here are your choices. One of them, I was actually going to run on Friday because Friday is Earth Day. And it's a guy named Eugene Linden, who is, I bet our pal Sandy, Environmental Coffee House, knows who Eugene Linden is. I don't know if she's in the chat room today or not, but he's an author and a scientist who writes on climate change and such issues. And his new book is called Fire and Flood, A People's History of Climate Change from 1979 to the Present. So that's one choice. The other choice is an interview I did with a woman named Louisa Lim. And her new book is called Indelible City: Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. And she was raised in Hong Kong. She wasn't born there, but she was raised there until her family moved away. But this is all about, you know, what's happened with China and Hong Kong and the fact that Hong Kong, which was under British rule and basically was a, you know, free state for the longest time, now reverts to Chinese rule and how that has impacted everything. And then this time that we're living in, the age of authoritarianism, which I'm afraid is just spreading more and more, that you know, one of those. I think that's a fascinating topic too. So if you guys have a choice, feel free to. It is 1933. Thank you. If you guys want to weigh in, I'll go with the majority. Either way, we're going to hear both these interviews in the coming days, so it doesn't really matter. But if you have a particular hankering for one, feel free. Okay. Sorry. See, I shouldn't read the chat while I'm doing the show. I can actually go back when I'm playing one of these interviews. So anyway, so weigh in. Louisa Lim on Hong Kong or Eugene Linden on climate change. One of those I will hit at the bottom of the hour. Okay. Okay. So yeah. What else? There's a lot of news out today. And most of it's not good. Let me just start with, though, what happened maybe an hour or so ago. A federal judge appointed by Donald Trump. Of course he was. She was. I think it's a woman. Did away with the mask mandate for travel. You know how they extended it for 2 weeks to go through May 3rd so that if you're on an airplane, on a train, on a bus, you still have to wear a mask. And masks are effective. They really are, as long as you're wearing the right kind of mask. I wear masks, right? Winston Smith likes the climate change one. And Mach 7 says Miss Lim. All right. And Ancient Pollyanna, I'm interested in Hong Kong. Okay, well, so, you know, and it, someone's got to tally them. I'm burbling? What does that mean, I'm burbling? The mask mandate is a woman. So Diane is saying I'm burbling. Diane, I don't know what that means. You got to speak English. Is my sound? Is my audio bad? Somebody explain. All right. Either way, I don't know. So anyway, I have a wobbly voice. Okay, you're telling me that my audio is fucked up, huh? That's weird. All right, I'm going to try one thing because I should have done this last time I had audio problems. So bear with me. It's going to go silent for a moment. We're going to try to reset here. Is this any better? Now the audio is back. So you guys were all telling me, yes, it's better now. Okay, better now. Yay! So I figured out there's a glitch in my board. So I guess when it goes bad, I just need to power off the board and then power it back on. I'm not drowning. Okay, it's okay now? Good. I guess I was, swimming in the water behind me. I don't know. Can you tell I shouldn't be here today? All right. So anyway, you guys decide between yourselves. I'll check back in with you as we get close to the bottom of the hour and better. Yay. Now Mach 7 says audio is bubbly. Is it still bubbly or is it better? I guess it's better. Sounds great now. Okay. It's live radio, people. All right. So a female judge appointed by the idiot Donald Trump did away with the mask mandate on transportation. So go figure. So that happened. What else? The situation in Ukraine is horrific. You can see behind me, those of you watching on one of the video feeds, that, now I don't have sound going into, this is not good. Do I have sound going in there? Okay, it looks like I've got sound going to... It's always one thing. So my audio stream is now out, but we're on PV. I think it's like, if it's not one thing, it's another. Hopefully someone will tell me if I'm not on Progressive Voices. I think we are, but I have no, damn it. Wonder if I do this, maybe that'll work. Okay. I don't know. It's technical problem Monday. See, the world has gone mad. All right, I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this? While I try to figure things out, how about a little song to lift us up? You know, I live here in Florida, where they just, this, I don't know if it's a school, but the State Board of Education probably, just rejected 41 or 43 of the textbooks they submitted, like math books that were rejected because they don't comply with Florida's new rules. Everything is foobar. Federal judge voids mask mandate for airplanes in other transportation settings. Federal judge on Monday, of course, in Florida, Her name is Catherine Kimball Mizell of the Middle District of Florida. I've never heard of the Middle District. Said the mandate exceeds the statutory authority of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It does not. Federal officials last week had extended the mask mandate for commercial flights and in other transportation settings, including on buses, ferries, and subways until May 3rd. Okay. Mizell, who was appointed by the former guy and clerked for Clarence Thomas, said the CDC had relied on a 1944 law, the Public Health Service Act, to impose the mandate. But the government's argument that it put the mask requirements in place for the purpose of sanitation falls short, she said. So everybody get COVID, right? Friend of David's, he hadn't spoken to in a while, and they're from New York, and they moved down to they live in New York. They came to Florida and went to Disney World, and of course got COVID. COVID's not over, people. COVID's still here. And in Florida, you know, the governor has a war on Disney. Why? Because they believe the Don't Say Gay bill, law now, is offensive. Guess what? It's offensive. I think they do say gay. Oh, they're done. Sandy and Richard Riccardi, you find them on the YouTubes, and they do these songs. I know nothing about them, but I think they're like a Broadway couple because they certainly sound like one. I needed that because obviously I'm in a weird place. So, all right, let's talk about Ukraine for a minute because it's a mess over there. So now, apparently, the Russians are this close to control of Mariupol. The only thing standing in their way are the Ukrainians who will not surrender. They refuse to surrender, even though the Russians tell them that they must, and they say that anybody who doesn't will be eliminated. Lovely. So, you know, CNN has been sending all of their main anchors over for a week or two or however long. Jake Tapper was there. I think Jake Tapper kind of jumped the shark recently, but that's okay. He actually sat down with President Zelensky. I haven't seen the whole thing yet, though what I have heard is pretty compelling. First of all, Zelensky says, yes, he wants Joe Biden to go.
Want President Biden to come here?
Yes.
Are there any plans for him to come?
I think he will.
You think he will?
I think he will. And I think he, but it's his decision, of course, and about the safety situation, it depends. I mean that, but I think he's the leader of the United States, and that's why he should come here to see.
He should go there to see. Although, you know, I think it's policy you keep the U.S. president out of the war zone, but hey, you know, what do I know? So Zelensky sat for this interview, and from the pieces that I heard, most of it he did in English. But occasionally, as you'll hear in this clip I'm about to play for you, I guess when he had a hard time coming up with the words that he wanted, he would revert back to his Ukrainian and a translator would pop in to translate what he said. And you could tell when it got emotional is when he had a hard time verbalizing the words in English. And what he was talking about when he got emotional was the old, you know, the dictum, the promise, never again. Now, what's happening in Ukraine is not like the Holocaust. The Holocaust was something unique to itself. And by the way, Holocaust Remembrance Day is coming up next week. Just throwing that out there. But I do believe what's happening in Russia is a form of, in Ukraine, is genocide on the part of Vladimir Putin. He has obviously given orders to kill civilians, to hurt them, to be as brutal as possible, because they are. And so I'm going to play a clip for you. It runs about 2 minutes, and it's only audio. Sorry, I don't have the video of it. Where Jake Tapper asked Zelensky about the promises, the world's promises of never again. You got to listen carefully because you hear the emotion in Zelensky's voice.
My cousin. You lost ancestors in the Holocaust. Every year on Holocaust Remembrance Day, politicians put out statements that say never again, never again.
Mm-hmm.
Those statements must seem really hollow right now to you. When the world says never again, do they ever mean it?
I don't believe the world.
I don't believe the world.
We see what's going on in Ukraine. I don't believe to this feeling that we should believe to some countries or some leaders. We don't believe the words. After escalation of Russia, we don't believe our neighbors. We don't believe all of this. Even I don't believe documents, because we also had a Budapest memorandum. I think you know all the details of this. For me, that is just a piece of paper and costs nothing. And that's it. So we just believe contrarian, pragmatic things. If you are our friends or partners, give us weapon, give us hand, give us support us, give us money, and stop Russia, kick Russia. You can do it if you are a friend. If you think about this, you know, this democracy and everything. Yes, all these moments. If you we have the same thoughts. If we are speaking about freedom, not because we want to have dialogue about freedom. If we are really things. Yes, if we're real, the same sorts. I mean,
the only belief there is belief in ourselves, in our people, belief in our armed forces, and the belief that countries are going to support us, not just with their words, but with their actions. And that's it.
Never again.
Really, everybody is talking about this, and yet, as you can see, not everyone has got the guts.
Really, everyone is talking about this, but as you can see, not everyone has got the guts. They talk about never again, but they go into a city like, what was the one? Bucha, and see bodies everywhere, and apparently, in Mariupol, it's even worse. So when they go in and they wipe out an entire city and kill men, women, children, it doesn't matter. Just kill and maim and execute as many people as possible. There's a problem there. And I get that the world is not just standing by and letting it happen in one sense, but in another sense, aren't we? Isn't this what happened? You know, World War II, before the United States got involved, certainly, and before we allowed refugees here, because boatloads of refugees from the Holocaust were turned away before we allowed them in. What does it take? And no, I'm not advocating for us to get involved in a nuclear war. It's the last thing I want. But I also can't just sit here and watch as these people are slaughtered the way they're being slaughtered. And they say that, you know, the offensive is happening. Here, Washington Post. Washington Post headline just came over 4 minutes ago. Russia's long-anticipated large-scale offensive in eastern Ukraine has begun, says Zelensky. The president of Ukraine is now saying it. Moscow has for weeks been amassing troops and supplies in preparation for its renewed assault on the Donbass region. Today, short while ago, Volodymyr Zelensky said, quote, "It can now be stated that the Russian troops have begun the battle for Donbas, for which they've been preparing for a long time." You know, I get the threat. Putin has nukes at his fingertips. Do you really think the decision on whether or not he'll use them has anything to do with what we do? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. But I also think he'll use them regardless if he's losing. So do we just let him win? You know, I don't have the answers, but I certainly feel like we're not doing all we can do. You know, some people walk the talk. Chef Jose Andres, if I'm saying his name, I think he pronounces it Jose. Could be Jose. I don't know. But he's one of the world's like greatest chefs. He runs he has the most expensive and highly rated restaurant in Miami. They've got him in New York and Los Angeles. But he goes out and he feeds people in need around the world. And he's got this world central kitchen that he's brought to Haiti. He brings to trouble spots. And you better believe it, he's in Ukraine as well. Well, guess what? The one in the city of Kharkiv was blown up by the Russians this weekend. Chef Andres has a whole video out. I'll try to remember to post it on the blog after the show. But let me just play this clip for you. It's the end of about a 4-minute video he posted to Twitter. And at the end of it, he talks about what happened at that restaurant that was set up to feed people who were bombed out of their homes.
A kitchen of ours, a partner in Yarko outside Kharkiv, was destroyed by a missile. We got 4 wounded friends, but they are okay. And today they moved the kitchen. They are going to be cooking tomorrow in another location. You see, the goodness always shines through. And we're going to keep cooking and feeding as many people as we can. And we only do it because we have your support. So thank you. Thank you for being there for us. I want you to know that we are here for the Ukrainian people. And together, hopefully, we will dream of a better tomorrow where sometimes a simple plate of food is the only way we know how to send a message of unity and a message of love. Longer tables, no higher walls, and especially no war. See you soon, guys.
I love that. Longer tables, no higher walls, and especially no war. So there were four staff members of this kitchen who were injured in the blast. Thankfully, they're all going to be okay. But this is just an example. This is an issue of right and wrong. And you know what? Chris Frederick in the YouTube chat room said exactly, we can't let him literally get away with rape and murder because he might do something worse. That's not how it works. But apparently it is. So I don't know what we do. You know, I am not a religious person. And that's even giving me too much. I'm an atheist. I am Jewish by tradition, by heritage, but I don't practice any religion. And I really think organized religion is one of the biggest problems we face because most wars are fought over God, of some kind of God, whatever your God may be. But so this week, is a weird intersection of some of the world's biggest religions. Now, just know, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism are not represented here. And I think they represent a pretty major part of the population. Again, I'm not a student of religion. This is when I really miss my friend George Rodriguez from SoFlo Radio, who passed away a couple of years ago, because he could talk religion and what a sham it is. And until the time runs out. But this week was something that happens maybe every 30 years or so. And so it was Friday night was the first night of Passover, right? Yesterday, and Passover runs for a few days. Don't ask me exactly how long, but it's not just one day. It's a few days. Sunday was Easter for Western religions. Eastern religions, I guess they're a week behind us. So their Easter is next Sunday, but this whole week is Holy Week. And this year in 2022, it just so happens that the month of April is Ramadan for the Muslim faith. So the fact that all three major holidays for three of the world's major religions, oh, I got to say Judaism is a smaller religion in terms of the world population than the others, but still three major religions all came together in this one week. By the way, they all celebrate different, I don't want to say different gods, and I'm certainly the wrong person to talk about religion in this sense. But, you know, the Christians believe Jesus is God, right? The Jews don't. And Islam believes in Muhammad, right? So we worship different entities and call it God. But so even with all of this holy energy brewing together, this weekend was uglier than usual because not only was the war horrific, but here at home, more mass shootings. I could have opened with if it were up to me, but I don't know where I draw the line anymore. But there was just this weekend, and in Pittsburgh, two teenage boys were killed and at least nine other people were injured in a shooting during a party at an Airbnb rental house. It was mostly kids there. In South Carolina, nine people were injured in a shooting at a nightclub. And at a mall, also in South Carolina, in Columbia, South Carolina, 14 people were hurt, nine by gunfire, and five were hurt in a stampede of shoppers as they were trying to escape. So obviously, even all the, you know, religious energy in the world didn't come together to make things better. So, you know, that so much for that experiment. And around the world, we see the rise of authoritarianism. In France, Marine Le Pen is this close. We'll know next week, but it is close, and she is a Putin ally. She could win the primary, if you will, last weekend, and the top two contenders are Marine Le Pen and Emmanuel Macron. And honestly, it's up to the liberals whether or not they'll vote for the more centrist Macron over the Trumpist Le Pen. But the future of France is at stake here and a whole lot more. And this shit's happening all over the world. So you know what? I think the interview we're going to do is the one on Hong Kong because this is playing out there. The world has taken a rightward turn and it's frightening and scary. And I got to tell you, it's up to us here in the United States to hold on to democracy, to the liberal democracy that we've enjoyed all these years, or else we're really screwed. But okay, for an example, let's talk about what's happening in Hong Kong and how they got there. You ready? All right, take it away. Take it away, Nicole. Now is Louisa Lim. She's the author of a new book, Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. But more than that, you were raised in Hong Kong. You are, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and all that.
Yes. Hi, Nicole. So hi. Nice to be here. So my father's Chinese and my mother's British, and I grew up in Hong Kong. And, you know, at the time it was a little bit unusual to be that way around. It was much more usual to have a Western father and a Chinese mother. And my parents found that they really were kind of outcasts in Hong Kong. There was this moment where my mother and I was about 6 years old and we were in a tea shop. And there were these old ladies sitting on the other side of the table and they started throwing tea leaves at me. And I just couldn't understand what was going on. My mother made me leave, and I was just so confused. And later on, she said to me, oh, we had to leave because they didn't want to see you. They didn't want to see you because they didn't like the way you looked. And later on, I realized that, you know, this sort of disappearance of mixed race people has been a theme that has run through Hong Kong's history. You know, in many ways, mixed race people have disappeared themselves.
You know, it's not just Hong Kong. It's in many other places, but obviously we're talking about Hong Kong today. So you lived there from the time you were young till when did you leave?
Well, I've worked there on and off for sort of many years. I covered Hong Kong's return to Chinese sovereignty as a very young journalist. And then I was based in China reporting for the BBC and NPR. And I was sort of traveling in and out of Hong Kong a lot, reporting from there when things happened. So I've kind of been in and out of there a lot for many years. And I went back there. I moved my children back there to do some of the research for the book in 2019. So I was there when the protests broke out. It was this enormous protest movement, a city of 7 million people. At a certain point, 2 million, so almost a third of the population, were out protesting on the streets against this extradition legislation, which they really felt undermined the city's way of life.
Sure. Now, you these days, you live in Melbourne, right? You're a journalist in Melbourne, Australia. But you've been covering China and Hong Kong for more than a decade, working as a correspondent for BBC and NPR, New York Times, Washington Post. You've been published everywhere. And this, you wrote another book as well, The People's Republic of Amnesia, dealing with what happened at Tiananmen Square. So this is your beat. You've been covering it, and you know it. You have a unique perspective on life in Hong Kong and China as a whole. I'm coming at this from somebody who, honestly, I know about China and Hong Kong, but not as much as I wish I did. And when you start looking at the history, I mean, centuries, thousands of years, right? There's a history that goes on forever. But in recent history, how we got to this place, for when you were a child, Hong Kong was under British control, right?
That's right. And there were negotiations between the British and the Chinese as to Hong Kong's future, because although certain parts of Hong Kong were ceded to Britain in perpetuity, the main part, the new territories, was on a 99-year lease, and that was due to run out in 1997. So there were these negotiations about Hong Kong's future, and Hong Kong has played no role in them. They were not at the table. They were not allowed to attend. There was no agreement. There was given to them for approval. There was no vote, no referendum. And when I was writing the book, I was very lucky to kind of stumble upon this trove of documents, which really gave us that Hong Kong view of those years. There were interviews with some of the most important Hong Kongers, people who were acting as advisors to the British government. And at the time, they were not allowed to speak openly about what they thought because they'd all signed the Official Secrets Act. But they'd done this series of interviews that was going to be released 30 years after the last events described in the interview. And I found this trove on a library shelf, and I was just kind of shocked when I read them because of the emotion and the anguish and all the things that they were not able to say that were sort of screaming out from these pages. And, you know, the thing that also shocked me was how unhappy they had been with this agreement to return Hong Kong to Chinese rule, how unhappy they were with the way the British had made that agreement, and the warnings that they had given both to the British and Chinese, just how accurate those warnings were. And, you know, the things they warn about are the things that we have seen play out in recent years. So it's kind of like this foreseen and foreseeable tragedy that unfolded.
So when the book opens in the prologue, you're talking about a scene on a rooftop in Hong Kong, and you're covering some basically guerrilla tactics of protesters who are writing these signs. Can you explain what was going on there and what your dilemma was?
Yes, absolutely. So this was in 2019, and it was right before the National Day protests. And I had been contacted by this collective. Now, I had known they existed, but I didn't know who they were. And they had become very famous for writing gigantic protest signs, sometimes, you know, 7 or 8 stories high, that would be hung from the territory's highest mountains. And there were these protest signs often calling for democracy, or in this case, they were against the extradition law that the protests were about. And they asked me if I wanted to go and watch them in action. So of course I said yes. And then, so I went, I was on this rooftop, I was watching this group who surprised me because they were much older people than I'd imagined. They weren't kind of young. They were quite elderly. And I was watching them paint. And I just, you know, I had this urge to join in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I come from a very traditional journalistic background where journalists are supposed to be observers, journalists are supposed to stand back and not take part in the action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a long time, I'd felt that I was having to choose between being a journalist and being a Hong Konger. And at that moment, I you know, it was almost like I knew I was going to do it. I felt like I probably shouldn't. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't want to write about it. But I did. I went and I joined in. And, you know, part of the reason was my fascination, obsession even, with this character called the King of Kowloon, who I write about in the book a lot. I just kind of wanted to know what it felt like to use words as weapons in that way.
Tell us about the King of Kowloon, because this is one of the way that people are dealing with the Chinese putting their authority back in place in Hong Kong. You talked about those calligraphers. You talk about other people who did it, but you say the main thread through all of it was the King of Kowloon. So what's this about?
So the King of Kowloon was this sort of extraordinary figure. He was an elderly, disabled trash collector whose mental competence was in question. And he believed that the peninsula of Kowloon, which is part of Hong Kong territory, that it had been stolen from his family back in the 19th century when it was ceded to Britain, and that it should be his and he should be the King of Kowloon. And he spent 50 years of his life writing across the city, on walls across the city, writing this calligraphy, claiming the city. And, you know, one of the extraordinary things about his calligraphy was that it was very ugly. It was, you know, terrible handwriting, all lopsided and not harmonious and beautiful, you know, really like a six-year-old's handwriting. But, you know, people have described him as Banksy before Banksy, Keith Haring before Keith Haring. You know, he was one of the very early graffiti artists. And over time, he became this cultural icon. So rap singers and lounge singers sang songs to him. Poets wrote ballads to him. He starred in television adverts, even for Louis Vuitton handbags. Wow. you know, he would play cameos in films, and he became Hong Kong's most valuable artist. I mean, he even represented Hong Kong at the Venice Biennale. He was the first Hong Kong artist to do so. So I was really fascinated with him. And one reason was because I thought the themes that he embodied, these ideas of dispossession and territory and sovereignty and loss, these are themes that really are still central to Hong Kong. And so I wanted to know more about him. I wanted to know, was he really the King of Kowloon? So I started to kind of track down all the people who'd known him and try and find out from them more about him. And it just kind of led me to this cast of eccentric, brilliant, artistic people, and political people as well. And, you know, it was really kind of my path through the book in many ways.
So you it's got to be different than other journalistic efforts where you're just covering a story from which you're, you know, really removed. There is no connection. But this was your life. This is your, you know, you say you weren't born in Hong Kong, but you grew up there. That's what formed you. And so watching the sea change. Now, so China, Hong Kong was supposed to return to China rule in 1997. What happened between 97 and the day of protest in 2019? Was it a total changing of the culture? I mean, what happened?
So it has been kind of quite incremental. But when Hong Kong returned to China in 1997, the agreement was that China was supposed to leave Hong Kong's way of life unchanged for 50 years. Uh-huh. So until 2047. And 2047. And China had promised to give Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy. And really, there were also these pledges to introduce democracy, but there was never any timeline, any kind of detail on how and when that would happen. And really, what we saw happen over the years was you know, this sort of slow erosion of these promises. The democracy was sort of kicked forward and forward and forward. It, you know, kept being promised. It said, oh, maybe it'll happen in 2012. And then 2012 came along. This, maybe it'll happen in 2016. Maybe it'll happen later. So everything just kept getting kicked on and on. And then in 2019, there was this attempt to introduce this extradition legislation, and Hong Kongers really felt that it undermined the idea of one country, two systems, which was meant to be the principle governing Hong Kong. They thought it undermined the high degree of autonomy, and so they really came out to protest then. I mean, there had been protests before, and they'd been sort of building, you know, each time they were bigger. But 2019 was where, you know, all of that kind of building frustration exploded into this massive movement. And then in 2020, we saw the introduction of national security legislation that was imposed on Hong Kong that has been very draconian and has really changed Hong Kong irrevocably.
So you know, we know about the authoritarian way that mainland China is governed. I mean, we're seeing it right now. There's a lot of conflict. I guess there's another wave of COVID going through, and they enacted a really strict lockdown, I think, in Shanghai. I'm not sure what city. But, you know, to the point where people are freaking out. They're locked in their homes. They cannot get out. There's been a lot of, I've heard reports of suicides, and it's bad. But there's such complete control there. Has it reached that level in Hong Kong as well?
We are seeing elements of that in Hong Kong. I mean, so what has happened is China's president, Xi Jinping, has endorsed this COVID zero policy. And really, the rest of the world has abandoned the idea of COVID zero. You know, with Omicron, it's almost impossible to have COVID zero. But in China, they're still doing that. And that has led to this incredibly strict lockdown, as you say, in Shanghai, but now we're seeing that spread into other cities as well. And actually, I think I saw up to something like 40% of China's population is under some kind of lockdown. But in Hong Kong also, they've had to follow the same COVID zero policy. And in many ways, they've used that to clamp down on Hong Kong and to stop protest activity. So at first, they stopped gatherings of only up to four people were allowed to gather at once. And then that was changed to just two people. And you were seeing like families of four people being fined for walking in public together and things like that. And in Hong Kong, the COVID zero policy has meant that if you test positive, you have to go into a quarantine camp. And if you have children, say your child tests positive, sometimes they have separated children as young as a year or two from their parents for up to 3 weeks. So we're seeing this huge outpouring, this exodus of people, particularly parents, who are terrified of the possible ramifications. So since the fifth wave of COVID started since the end of last year. We've seen 150,000 people leaving Hong Kong, and that rate is getting faster and faster. So 50,000 people left in the first 2 weeks of March alone. You know, people are going so fast, they're abandoning their sort of expensive cars in car parks. And they're stopping flights to Hong Kong because no flight crews want to go there because they're worried about, you know, getting sent to quarantine camps. So in many ways, this is allowing the COVID zero policy is also chipping away at China's status as a major international city.
Wow. Louisa Lim is our guest. Her book is Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. It's actually not even, it's coming out on Tuesday, on the 19th of April. And you're in Melbourne, Australia, so we're taping this. It's like the middle of the night there. You're doing a whole string of interviews. You're drinking a lot of coffee, I'm guessing. And I saw the brownies, so maybe the sugar from the brownies is keeping you going. I appreciate you doing this. You know, again, we here in the U.S., and I'll just speak for myself, don't know enough about China. I do know, you know, the rule of Xi and how right now, you know, apparently the Chinese government is siding with Russia, and I'm watching what's happening with Ukraine. I've been in communication with a woman from Ukraine who left and went to Poland and is now in Dubai with her sister, just agonizing over what's happening to her country. And I'm seeing so many similar things. You write about the protesters. Some of the people who are protesting these policies in Hong Kong weren't even alive in 1997 when the rule changed. But it's been incremental change. So they're seeing their freedoms be whittled away with each passing year.
That's right. And I mean, you know, I was really struck by how well-informed the protesters were. I spent a lot of time there when the protests were happening. And, you know, I'll never forget, I was interviewing, and I interviewed a pair of 15-year-olds. And, you know, they were telling me how they used to spend their weekends playing football, playing soccer. Mm. And now they were spending their weekends at the protests, you know, dodging tear gas and running away from police. And I, you know, there's a 10-year jail sentence for rioting in Hong Kong, and being part of the protests is seen as rioting. So I, you know, I remember I asked them, you know, you're only 15. If you get a 10-year sentence, that's like 2/3 of your life. Yeah. Are you really willing to pay that price? And I was just struck by the way in which they said, you know, this is the end game for Hong Kong. And, you know, we understand what the stakes are and we're willing to be here. And I think many people did see it as the end game. And now, you know, the end game, in a way, it's played out. And what we're seeing is people leaving Hong Kong. And I think in many ways that was perhaps, you know, China's endpoint, China's vision of Hong Kong in the future is not of a preeminent international city. It's just as part of China's Greater Bay Area, which is one of a number of cities like Guangzhou and Shenzhen and other large cities in southern China. And, you know, maybe the logical end of COVID zero and of, you know, the national security legislation is to try to turn Hong Kong into just another Chinese city and, you know, a Chinese city where dissent and free thinking and it is no longer permissible.
Right. You know, what's frightening to me, and I see it as a trend, you've looked around the world. I'm in South Florida. I don't know if you're following what's going on over here, but we've got a governor who fashions himself after the former president, Trump, who is, you know, insane and wants to turn this country into another authoritarian regime. He he thinks Vladimir Putin's a genius. He has said of the invasion, it's genius. It's not genius. It's horrific. And we're seeing, so in Russia, I saw a piece last night, I guess the Wall Street Journal had reported on it, that in towns in Russia, people who work at grocery stores are using the price tags on the shelves to write what, you know, Russia is bombing the people in Ukraine. They've bombed so many maternity hospitals and things like this in the fine print on the grocery store shelf. So they're resorting to whatever methods they can to get the message out, knowing that if they're caught, they're subject to 10, 15 years in prison. It seems like there are a lot of parallels. And it seems like around the world, as Hong Kong is falling further under authoritarian rule, the rest of the world is heading in that direction, too. You look in France, Marine Le Pen is once again a threat to the society there. She very likely could beat Macron in this election that we'll know in less than 2 weeks. So is it a trend around the world? Is the world following what's happening in Hong Kong, or is it coincidence? Or maybe this is a question that's just too out there.
I mean, I think there are through lines that run through what we're seeing, and one of them is the power of propaganda. Mm-hmm. You know, that power of narrative control. And we see that in China, and we see that in Russia. In particular, you know, these stories of Russian families whose children are in Ukraine, and, you know, parents not believing what their own children are telling them, because the hold of state propaganda is just so strong.
Right.
And so I think that's kind of a through line. And China as well has been following Russia's propaganda on Ukraine and amplifying it in so many ways. So, I mean, I think, you know, this trend towards authoritarianism is really, you know, it is really alarming. And in many ways, you know, what is a tragedy is that in Hong Kong, where people really tried to struggle and, you know, put their own lives at risk for democratic ideals, that, you know, that struggle has, you know, in many ways it has been forgotten.
People in Hong Kong are still fighting for their freedom. They're fighting against this deal that was made without their permission, or are they?
Well, since 2020 in June, this national security legislation was imposed on Hong Kong by Beijing, and it's incredibly draconian. Mm. So it's against secession, subversion, collusion with foreign powers, and terrorism. But these offenses are not defined, and it's applied very broadly. So we've seen, you know, six people were found, were charged for clapping in a courtroom, and people have also been charged for having stickers with banned protest phrases and things like that. So it does mean that it's very hard for people to know where the red lines are. Mm-hmm. You know, people often say in Hong Kong there are no red lines anymore. It's just kind of a red sea. And so nowadays, you know, really the only guarantee of security is silence. So people are leaving. People are leaving. They're moving overseas. And, you know, activists overseas have said to me that the battlefield is shifting and it's now becoming global. And that people, Hong Kongers overseas, are doing more because Hong Kongers inside Hong Kong, you know, that it's just not possible anymore.
Right. Well, and so I guess it's more of a global fight now. Again, I'll bring up Florida, where this crazy governor we have signed legislation that says it's anti-protest legislation, basically saying too many people will call it a riot, and riots are illegal. And if you're marching, excuse me, in the street, cars can legally run you down. The kind of stuff they're doing is just insane. And it's that slippery slope towards an authoritarian government. And if I'm afraid if, you know, this guy wants to be president and the polls are, if it's not Trump, he's next in line. And it's frightening over here. So it's nice to see the whole world sort of battling the same kind of issues. But it seems like we're on the losing end of it. I hate to say it, but it's all the more important, I think, for people to understand what's happening around the planet, because in many places we're all battling the same kind of thing. So, you know, you dedicate the book. I love your dedication. It says, we're on the internet, so I can read it, to all those who really fucking love Hong Kong. Do you still love Hong Kong?
Oh, absolutely. And the reason that I used that dedication was after the national security legislation passed, it became very difficult to use any protest slogans because it became risky. And so people started instead making banners saying, I really fucking love Hong Kong. Because so that's almost become a sort of statement of defiance in itself. And I just thought it was the perfect dedication because, you know, you can read it on different levels.
Sure. Just like one of the signs that you were quoting when you were up on that rooftop and you gave the translation. And I guess it doesn't translate well into English, but it's profane and it can be interpreted, I guess, in different ways. But, you know, the Chinese people who, again, I don't speak Chinese, I don't know, but I guess they're not beyond using language creatively.
Absolutely not. And I mean, you know, in Hong Kong, the language that is spoken, Cantonese, is a sort of incredibly sweary, incredibly creative language, which is really emotional. And, you know, and it is one big difference between the Cantonese and those people in Beijing who speak Mandarin, which is much more regimented. Okay. It's, you know, much more standardized. And that's, you know, one of the sort of key differences as well.
So Cantonese is the looser, more fun in that. That's what they speak in Hong Kong. It's tragic what's happened there. And I'm glad to hear the young people are rebelling against the people who were not alive under the previous system are still saying this isn't right. We need to fight this. It's our only hope for the future. And I hope, you know, I talk to this woman from Ukraine almost every day and watching what's happening there. And I'm scared for the world. So, you know, voices of resistance are important to amplify. And that's what you're doing here in this book. Louisa Lim, thank you so much. The book is Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. Thank you for this. And thank you for staying up all night to talk to us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Nicole.
My pleasure. Thank you. Louisa Lim, fascinating story. You know, again, with all that's going on in the world, what we're fed, the news coverage we're fed, is a very limited menu. So it's up to us to reach out and see what's happening around the world. The problem is, it seems like it's a lot of the same shit, different places. We, as a planet, seem to be on a horrible trajectory. And I think it's up to us to turn it around in November. And right now, the indications are not good. So we need to we really need to band together to do something about it. I didn't get the chance to read it today. I will tomorrow. Elizabeth Warren has a New York Times op-ed. And in it, she has an idea how Democrats can avoid disaster in November is the title of it. And she's got a plan. And that's good because someone has to come up with a plan. And I'll take Elizabeth Warren. And if no one else is stepping up, bring it on, Elizabeth Warren. We need it desperately. Thanks for listening, everybody. So, that's the show. That's today. Tomorrow's Tuesday. It's every other Tuesday. So Gotta Laugh will be here. So I will be here tomorrow. I'll let you know I'm taking Wednesday off, but I'll be here tomorrow. And it's important. Again, Hong Kong is barely a blip on the radar of the news, corporate, mainstream corporate news here. So, but we need to know what's going on around the world. And Xi, the leader of China, now also the leader of Hong Kong, not exactly an ally these days. World's a scary place. Yeah. All right. That's it for today. I will see you tomorrow. We'll be back with Laffy, hopefully with some laughs as well. I'll see you. I'll leave you with the news. And once again, as always, thank you for listening. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Following another weekend of heavy shelling and bombardment across the country, Ukrainian forces are rejecting Russia's demands that they voluntarily lay down arms and surrender. Russia's Ministry of Defense on Sunday said that Ukrainian forces still defending Mariupol will be eliminated. If the city falls, Russia will control an unbroken land bridge connecting the separatist-controlled territory in eastern Ukraine with Crimea. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told CNN that Ukraine is not willing to give up territory in the eastern part of the country to end the war with Russia. He also acknowledged that Ukraine is suffering horrific civilian casualties. He said at least 191 children have been killed since the start of the Russian invasion, with hundreds of others injured. At least 7 people were killed and another 11 also injured in Russia's first major attack on Lviv. Lviv is the largest Ukrainian city closest to Poland, and it's where refugees from Ukraine's embattled east have descended upon to escape the air raids until now. Ukrainian forces are also facing ammunition shortages. President Biden announced last week that the U.S. is sending Ukraine 40,000 artillery rounds as part of an arms shipment, but that might last them only a few days. In addition to the human carnage and the horrific destruction wreaked by the Russian troops, reports are surfacing that they're also deliberately destroying agricultural infrastructure and supply chains. Germany's agriculture minister is arguing that this could all lead to global food shortages, as Ukraine is one of the world's largest wheat exporters. President Zelensky sat down with CNN's Jake Tapper for an interview, and he held nothing back when asked about the world leaders proclaiming never again.
The only belief there is belief in ourselves, in our people, belief in our armed forces, and the belief that countries are going to support us, not just with their words, but with their actions. And that's it.
Never again.
Really, everybody is talking about this, and yet, as you can see, not everyone has got the guts.
One of the restaurants set up to help feed people in Ukraine as part of Chef Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen was struck and destroyed on Saturday. 4 staff members were injured. Chef Andres tweeted an update on Sunday.
A kitchen of ours, a partner in Yarko outside Kharkiv, was destroyed by a missile. We got 4 wounded friends, but they are okay. And today they moved the kitchen. They are going to be cooking tomorrow in another location. You see, the goodness always shines through, and we're going to keep cooking and feeding as many people as we can. And we only do it because we have your support. So thank you. Thank you for being there for us. I want you to know that we are here for the Ukrainian people. And together, hopefully, we will dream of a better tomorrow where sometimes a simple plate of food is the only way we know how to send a message of unity and a message of love. Longer tables, no higher walls, and especially no war.
People of faith may have hoped for a miracle this past weekend as the stars aligned for an unusually holy week. For Christians, Easter was on Sunday, though in Eastern countries it's this coming Sunday. For Jews, Passover or Pesach began Friday night, and April this year is the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. That all three fall at the same time is a concurrence that happens only once every 30 years or so. But even with all that holy energy brewing together, the war and the rest of the ugliness continues. Here at home, it took the form of more mass shootings. 2 teen boys were killed and at least 9 other people injured in Pittsburgh early Sunday in a shooting during a party at an Airbnb short-term rental. In South Carolina, 9 people were injured in a shooting at a nightclub. 14 were hurt, 9 by gunfire and 5 in a stampede of shoppers in a shooting in a Columbia, South Carolina mall. And in Grand Rapids, Michigan, peaceful protests continue in the wake of yet another police shooting of yet another unarmed black man. The cop's body cam footage has now been seen, but interestingly enough, the video goes dark 42 seconds before the officer shoots Patrick Loyoya in the head. Lordy, there are text messages. They're from Republican Senator Mike Lee and Republican Congressman Chip Roy to the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. And they show that they plotted with other high-ranking Republicans to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election defeat right up until the Capitol riot. That's when they started worrying that things could, quote, backfire badly, according to Lee. Wow. And, well, if it's Monday, your taxes are due. If you're running late, file an extension and know that the IRS is also running late. It's contending with its biggest backlog in history. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.